Hello, and welcome to another edition of Maplewood Barn Radio Theater, brought to you in conjunction with KBIA. Tonight, we bring you a humorous piece of caper fiction called Mr. Clockworthy Tells the Truth by Christopher B. Booth. It was first published in the October 19, 1920 issue of Detective Story magazine. Now we hope you enjoy this presentation by the Maplewood Barn Radio Players. Tonight's story takes us to Chicago, known as the Windy City, not because of the weather, but because of the hot air blown about by the politicians and crooks. And speaking of crooks and charlatans, let's look in on two men, the tall, prepossessing, elegantly tailored Mr. Clockworthy and his co-plotter, James Early, known as the Early Bird.
James, I do not believe that anyone will deny that the city's transportation is wholly inadequate. The surface and elevated lines themselves admit it. The whole population has grown beyond them. High costs of construction preclude any plans of extension because the banks refuse to accept present inflated values as a fair basis.
Please shoot lower, boss. You are three syllables beyond my range.
There has been considerable agitation for a subway, but a tube is expensive even at normal times, and now with labor and material costs sky high, no popular priced fare would permit a subway company to pay the interest on its bonds.
You mean the nickel grabbers couldn't drag in enough jack to keep the subway out of hock?
Precisely, James. The popular demand, as you know, is for a 5-cent fare. The city administration has been struggling with all sorts of schemes. Several months ago, you may recall, there was considerable publicity given to the Monotrack system, which is used in some of the European cities.
I gotcha. I seen the pictures in the papers. A car hanging up in the air on a wire rope. Sort of reminded me of the stunt we used to play when I was a kid in Allen's Alley. We used to give the cat a ride by sliding a basket along Ma's clothesline.
A bit like that, perhaps, James. But to get to the point, the strong feature of the Monotrack system was the small cost of construction. The single track would be suspended by the support of an iron framework, the power being supplied by the third rail system. It would mean much less expense in securing right-of-way, as much less space would be needed.
Why don't they go ahead and build it, with shoes costing 18 beanos and...
The city administration was much in favor of the plan and even went so far as to grant a franchise to the Monotrack Transit Company. The company was incorporated for $200,000, just a preliminary organization, you know, and its prospects were so bright that the stock sold for par and went quite readily, too. But you can't float a company on optimism and franchise, James. When the big bankers turned down the scheme, the price of Monotrack tumbled to $10 a share and no takers. James, I propose that you and I revive poor dying Monotrack as it lies at the door of the stock market, gasping its last.
Great Goshen, you mean you're going to build a car line?
How you do jump at conclusions. James, I didn't say that I intended to build a Monotrack system. I am merely going to revive the stock.
I getcha. You ain't going to build it. You're just going to make some of these rich birds think you're going to build it.
Yes, that's what I propose to have them think. Yes, my early bird, we have a mission, you see.
Mrs. Clara Cartwright was a sweet but not nearly so trusting a woman as she had been 6 months before. The reason for her recently developed skepticism reposed in a bureau drawer of her modest home. Four highly engraved and very prosperous-looking stock certificates showed her to be the possessor of 2,000 shares of stock in the Monotrack Transit Company. She had paid for the stock with every cent that her lamented husband had left her in a life insurance policy to smooth an otherwise impoverished widowhood. The stock was sold to her by a family friend, that eminent suburban banker, Mr. Cyrus Prendeville. But of course, in the plainest words, that Prendeville was a crook. Other bankers and businessmen were accustomed to scrutinize carefully any sort of transaction with him. He had been one of the prime movers in the organization of the Monatrack Transit Company, and being on the inside of the deal, Mr. Prendeville had purchased 2,000 shares at a generous discount. For a time, Mr. Prendeville shared the optimism of the scheme's other promoters, but his shrewd little gimlet-like eyes soon saw the handwriting across the certificates and read, "Nothing doing." So, in selling off the now worthless stocks to the widow, Cyrus Prendeville was some $20,000 richer. But there was one thing which Mr. Prendeville did not know, and he never would. And that one thing was the very reason Mr. Clackworthy set out on the present scheme. On the 19th floor of the Great Lakes building was a most elegantly furnished office suite. The lettering on the door read, "Atlas Investment Company." In the outer room, a pretty young woman was seated before a typewriter desk. She was reading a popular novel, but as the door to the office opened, she started to shove the book into the drawer. Oh, she retrieved the book immediately, seeing the visitor was one James Early.
"Why, Mrs. Bascom, you's in on the adventure this time?"
"Can't let George have all the fun. And besides, he doesn't look as good in a dress."
A draftsman board stood in one corner, and it held some half-completed drawings bearing the words Monatrack Transit Company. Seated in front of the draftsman's board was George Bascom, who at the present moment was using the point of his dividers to clean his fingernails, which in truth was about the only use he could really make of them.
"Besides, I can't type a lick."
"That's a for sure."
"Is the boss in?"
"For you, always. Go on in."
"Some joint."
"James, your idiomatic English is most refreshing, but it becomes my duty to remind you that you are now the private secretary of a conservative investment broker, and as such, you must speak with more refinement."
"Don't worry the old think box into a headache. I'll can the lowbrow chatter when the lamb appears for shearing."
"James, human nature is very contradictory. How often do we reject the truth and yet receive falsehood with childish credulity?"
"The bottomless pit's only knee-deep compared with your lingo."
"Here is an example of my philosophy. If I went to the Black Mare Hotel with 17 trunks and a valet and announced that I was a millionaire, no one would believe me. Yet, if I went to the same hotel with the same trappings and denied that I was a millionaire, everyone would be quite convinced that I was. Well, James, that is the philosophy upon which our present little venture is founded. I do not think it can fail."
Mr. Cyrus Prendeville tilted back in his swivel chair, and his heavy eyebrows over his beady little eyes contracted into a puzzled frown as he stared at the open page in his hands.
"Atlas Investment Company, 1924 to 1926, Great Lakes Building. Impressive letterhead, very dignified. Never heard of him. It may amount to something, though. Let's see. Dear sir, we are given to understand that you are the owner of 2,000 shares of stock in the Monatrack Transit Company. We are delegated by a client of ours to purchase a controlling amount of this stock in order that he may acquire the plans and specifications which belong to the company. We are empowered to offer you the present market price of $10 per share. As you are well aware, the revival of the company is a financial impossibility, and our client has no other reason for acquiring this stock than to become the owner in fee simple of its drawings, which he hopes may be an asset at some future time. Come, they're too darn emphatic about wanting only the plans and specifications. This is well worth looking into. But damn me, I am no longer a possessor of those shares. But remembering the tears and moans of Mrs. Clara Cartwright on discovering that her $60,000 worth of certificates were utterly worthless, I anticipate no difficulty in buying them back for, say, $10 a share. Ha-ha! Dawes! Dawes!
You called, sir?
You're even more widely acquainted with the many details of the city's financial circle than I am. Just who are the Atlas Investment Company?
The name's vaguely familiar. Mr. Prindivale, I don't seem to place them. However, I will find out. Operator, Wabash 245, please.
Was I too hasty in unloading those stocks? Easily corrected, I hope.
Sir, Fisher and Fisher have just told me that the Atlas people are an exclusively small concern, soliciting no public business, and it's well understood that they are private agents for a very reputable financier. In short, they confine their activities to the confidential matters of J.K.
What? Merciful heaven, J.K.? Mr. J.K. Easterday, president of three big banks and financial power extraordinaire. What he says is financial law. J.K. Easterday, my word!
It was not within Mr. Prindivale's province to know, but the original Atlas Investment Company had a few days before removed their offices from the Great Lakes building, and that Mr. Clackworthy had hurriedly leased them, neglecting to remove the neat gilt lettering from the door. As Mr. Prindivale opened the door of 1924 Great Lakes building, the scene of the luxuriant solidity was somehow just as he had pictured it. Mrs. George Bascom hurried her slim fingers over the typewriter keyboard. Over in the corner, George Bascom wrinkled his brow over his draftsman's board.
Young woman, I wish to see Mr. Clackworthy.
Busy just at this moment. If you will just have a chair, I will let you know when Mr. Clackworthy is free.
The chair, it happened through careful calculation, was within easy vision of the drafting board. As Mr. Prindivale strained his neck for a closer inspection of the drawings, Mr. Bascom glanced at him suspiciously and draped a large piece of paper over the mass of lines and angles, but not before Prindivale read the words, Monotrack Transit Company.
Ah, secrecy. I knew that something was afoot, foxy old J.K.
Inside the private office, Mr. Clackworthy calmly smoked his cigar and marked time. The master confidence man had adopted none of his long list of pseudonyms, for he had carefully laid his plans strictly within legal bounds. Even his possession of the abandoned offices of the Atlas Investment Company and the use of that name on his letterheads were entirely according to law. Happily, the genuine company had neglected the little formality of registering with the Secretary of State, and Mr. Clackworthy had spent the required incorporation fee in appropriating the name. A moment later, the early bird, hurrying in from the street with an armful of important-looking documents, paused at Mrs. Bascom's desk. He sighed and mopped his brow.
Mr. Clackworthy?
Waiting for you. You'd better hurry up with those papers. J.K. is in there with him, and they want them quick.
Just catching my breath. I'll get these right in.
Watch yourself, sir. Don't want you to fall on your face. And I assure you, the door is quite soundproof.
The early bird smiled as he dumped the papers in the inner office.
Well, old Gimlet Eyes is out there waiting.
Yes, I know. Mrs. Bascom pressed the buzzer a moment ago. How do you size him up?
As nervous as a Pennsylvania millionaire about to meet King George.
Watch your English, James.
Well, as I was gonna say, if you keep that man out there very long, he's gonna wear the seat out of his pants squirming around in the chair.
That's fine, James. Now you may retire to the outer office while I complete my conference with, J.K. Remember my instructions.
The early bird bowed solemnly to the empty chair across from Mr. Clackworthy, grinned, and made for the door.
I've got it down pat.
In the outer office, James went to his desk, which stood for a few feet from where Mr. Prindivale was seated. Slowly, he began to sort over a stack of papers. Mr. Prindivale edged his chair a few inches closer.
Have a cigar, fine tobacco. Import them myself direct. You have a very nice office here.
Uh-huh.
By the way, I thought I saw my old friend J.K., fellow banker of mine, you know, come in just ahead of me. Does he transact much business with this firm?
Never heard of him.
Never heard of JK? That's quite a joke.
Never heard of him.
I see. It's a dark secret. Oh, I'm on.
On to what?
I know JK mighty well. Personal friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
As if planned, and of course it was, George Bascom removed the improvised paper shield from the draftsman's board.
Bascom, I don't want any more work on that just now. Hasn't Mr. Clackworthy told you that—
Quite right, Mr. Early. I get ahead of myself sometimes.
Mr. Prindevale's nostrils quivered.
Something big afoot. Something mighty big. And I'm just the chap to get to the bottom of it.
At the end of 30 minutes, Mr. Clackworthy gave the button on his desk three swift jabs, and the early bird appeared.
I got him going. He tried to pump me for all he was worth about this JK stuff.
James, you chew tobacco on occasions, do you not?
Chew? Now, ain't that a question to ask a guy with the little lamb outside waiting for the Clippers? Gonna get me to sign the pledge?
James, you know I abhor the vile habit, but it now becomes necessary for me to ask you to masticate a generous portion of this plug of tobacco. Strew it around the general vicinity of that $75 cuspidor. No, no, I'm not jesting. It's part of the stage setting.
Right, boss.
That's fine. And, James, I will see Mr. Prindevale now.
I'll let myself out.
A moment later, Mr. Prindevale entered, glancing swiftly about. The first thing that caught his eye was the dark tobacco stains that decorated the floor. He smiled in triumph. J.K. Easterday's careless way of chewing tobacco was notorious in moneyed circles.
Ah, looks as if my old friend J.K. has been here.
J.K. who?
As if there was more than one J.K. Easterday.
J.K. Easterday has not been here. What would that big fellow be doing up here in my humble old domain?
Have it your way.
Mr. Prindevale, I know that you are a busy man, and I will not take your time by lengthy and needless explanations. You have 2,000 shares of Monotrack Transit that you couldn't sell for scrap paper. The last selling price was $10 a share. For the purpose stated in my letter to you, my client is willing to give you the last quoted market price. That's the whole thing in a nutshell. Did you bring your shares with you?
Tut, tut. Not so fast. I'm too old a head to be rushed like that. Come, my dear sir, give me credit for a little intelligence. When I play stud poker, I like to see a few of the cards on the table before I bet.
You are intimating.
Intimating nothing. Mr. Clackworthy, I know for a positive fact that you've got an ace up your sleeve.
I have stated the proposition just as it
is. Just as it isn't. I've got 2,000 shares of Monotrack Transit. Someone wants them, and that someone happens to be J.K. And when old J.K. wants anything, he pays the price for it, if he has to.
You are entirely misleading yourself, Mr. Prindevale. J.K. Easterday has nothing to do with this matter.
Has it, eh? Then maybe you can explain this. A closely typewritten page with a scrawled but entirely legible OKEH JK? Don't tell me. I know already. That's JK Easterday's OK mark. OKEH, the Indian mark of approval. There are only two men in America who write it that way. The President of the United States and JK Easterday.
Bosh! I wrote that down there myself. You are jumping to conclusions.
Mr. Clackworthy was showing a most remarkable tenacity for the strict letter of truth.
Lay the cards down on the table, and I'll talk turkey.
Really, Mr. Prindevale, you are getting rather needlessly excited. I wish to play a game of golf this afternoon, and I want to get this business over with. Suppose we say $15 a share.
It cost me more than that. I made up my mind that I'll hold on to that stock until I came out of it whole or let the paper rot.
Well, Mr. Prindevale, if you really feel that way about it, possibly we could pay you a price that would permit you to recover your original investment. You did not, I am reliably informed, pay the par value.
Ha! I trapped you that time. So it's worth something after all, eh? How much is it worth?
Mr. Clackworthy slid his foot under the desk and touched the electric button secreted there. It connected with a faint alarm on the early bird's desk, who in turn touched a button connected to the telephone on Mr. Clackworthy's desk. The bell tinkled. In the act of lifting the receiver from the hook, Mr. Clackworthy turned to the suburban banker.
Granting for the sake of reaching an agreement that you paid the par value of $100 a share and taking cognizance of your determination to come out whole on it, I am empowered to offer you... Hello? Yes, this is Mr. Clackworthy. Yes, Abushan. Uh-huh. Yes, I understand. He's here now.
Mr. Prindeville looked up quickly, saw that Mr. Clackworthy's gaze had grown hard and cold. The banker realized that something had gone wrong.
Mr. Prindeville, there is no need to discuss this matter further. I find that I shall not need to buy the stock from you after all.
But I don't understand.
Oh, yes, I think you do. One of my men has reported that you sold your Monatrack holdings some months ago to some woman. We shall, of course, deal directly with the current holder of the stock.
Mr. Prindeville grabbed his hat and fled. Prindeville cursed the slow elevators, ran down the stairs, and bolted out of the entrance down to the drugstore at the corner, where he knew there was a telephone booth. Mrs. Clara Cartwright's soft voice soon identified herself from the other end of the wire.
Mrs. Cartwright, about the Monatrack stock which I sold you, I've been thinking it over and I realized that it was entirely upon your faith and my advice that you purchased it. And I could not in all fairness expect you to pay for the burden of my sincere but mistaken judgment. So I've decided to take the stock off your hands without a cent of loss to you by returning your $60,000 investment.
Oh, Mr. Prindeville, how lovely of you.
Yes, so I will be right over and give you a check.
Oh, there is no hurry, Mr. Prindeville, so long as you promise.
But there is a hurry. I mean, I am in a hurry to get it off my mind. I know you will feel better with things fixed up. I might die tonight. And, you know, there's been no one out to see you about buying the stock, I suppose.
Oh, no. Who would want to buy it?
Oh, well, of course not, of course not, but... in case someone did talk to you about it, I would advise you to do nothing until you talk to me.
A taxicab driver, bribed with a $20 bill, broke all the speed records in getting Mr. Prindeville out to the suburb. The banker found Mrs. Cartwright in her sitting room, evidently waiting for him. She had the stock certificates in her hand.
I'll just write a check, Mrs. Cartwright.
Why, Mr. Prindeville, you act so excited. I do believe that something has happened to the Monatrack business.
No. Just my conscience giving me a bit of a bother. Here you are. I will not allow you to lose a cent.
I've got, what do you men call it, a hunch? I have decided not to sell for the $30 a share I originally paid.
Just as you will. I try to play Good Samaritan and am at once suspected of some underhanded scheme to cheat you.
I am sorry if I have misjudged you. Of course, if you are sincere in your offer, I suppose. But I can't get rid of that hunch. Something seems to tell me that I should not sell my stock for $30 a share.
And I presume your hunch also tells you just what price you will get?
Now let's see. Now isn't that funny? A figure just pops into my mind. $80 a share.
Come, Mrs. Cartwright, I'll tell you what I will do. Since I have caused you quite a little worry over your apparent loss of $60,000, I will permit you to make a little profit, out of my own pocket, you know. I will give you $35 a share.
Mrs. Cartwright laughed. This was the cue for Mrs. Cartwright's trusted servant, Amelia, to connect the electric current, which caused a telephone bell to ring in another room. The banker was engulfed with apprehension. That might be J.K.'s men. He was somehow almost sure that it was.
As I was saying...
Miss Cartwright, there's a man on the phone who wants to speak to you. His name is Clack. Clack something.
Just a minute, Mr. Prindeville. You will excuse me for a moment?
Wait. Let us close this up before you go. Now let me see. Clackworthy promised to pay the par value of $100 per share. That would be an even $200,000. If I pay Mrs. Cartwright $160,000, that's a $40,000 profit. After all, a good killing.
Did you say something, Mr. Prendeville?
You said you would take $80 a share?
Oh, but I was just joking, really. Surely you...
You gave me your word, your promise that you would take $80 a share. You can't back out now. I'm writing you a check right now. Here's my check, and now please hand over the stocks. Please?
Well, I suppose if it means that much to you...
Mr. Prendeville dashed out of the house. Mrs. Cartwright then dashed to the telephone.
Operator, Wabash 232, please. Amos Clackworthy, you darling, darling man. We have met the enemy, and his check is ours. I'm going to rush right out and have it certified. Then I will be right down and give you your half of our profit. I must say, it's great to have a cousin who has such a wonderful brain as yours.
And that would end the story, except for Mr. Prendeville being what is sometimes sneeringly referred to as a rotten loser. When the suburban banker trotted triumphantly up to the Great Lakes building the following day, he was amazed to find the offices of the Atlas Investment Company vacant. It gradually dawned upon him that something was wrong. In his first burst of rage, he visited the district attorney's office and laid bare the amazing story. The district attorney, viewing the case from all angles, decided that perhaps morally Mr. Cyrus Prendeville had been most thoroughly buncoed, but that legally he had merely made an unfortunate investment. The prosecutor bowed Mr. Prendeville out of the office with scant sympathy. By rare coincidence, the district attorney was also a nephew of no less illustrious person than J.K. Easterday, and that was how J.K. got hold of the story and explains an otherwise mysterious communication that Mr. Amos Clackworthy received. Mr. Clackworthy and the early bird were at breakfast when the morning mail came. From under the edge of the white tablecloth protruded one of Early Bird's new $20 shoes.
20 smackers this time, and worth it. And this pair ain't gonna get chawed up by no plebeian. That's right, it ain't. Sodbusters. I went down on Bull Meesh yesterday and laid out 2,000 Iron Men for the niftiest little racer that ever landed a guy in the speeder's court.
Speaking, James, of our most recent adventure, you will, I think... find this the crowning touch.
What's this? It is gossiped in financial circles that Cyrus Prendeville, an exceedingly shrewd banker, has recently endowed the School of Experience with the munificent gift of $100,000.
And scrawled across one corner in a bold, masterful hand with the letters OKEHJK. That concludes our little tale of Mr. Clackworthy Tells the Truth, adapted from a Christopher Booth short story by Dave Collins. Our players included Michael Tooley as Mr. Clackworthy, Joe Bogue as Early Bird, David McSpadden as the banker Prendeville, and Alana Berrigan Scott was the Widow Cartwright. Also in the cast were Darren Helwig as Dawes and Mr. Bascom, and Patricia Humphrey as Mrs. Bascom and the Maid. This is your narrator, Byron Scott, hoping you'll join us again next Friday night for another story from Maplewood Barn Radio Theater, right here on KBIA.